I am Jonna. I'm an addict. I'm also an alcoholic. I am bi-addicted to any substance that's out there, basically. Very grateful to be here. It's an honor to speak. 9 years ago this month, I wasn't going to make it. I was the kind of drinker and drug user who doesn't survive. And the tablets I took, the quantity of alcohol I consumed, and the amount of powder I put in my body was going to kill me. And I'm only back here because of the fellowship of these rooms. And so I never want to forget that. Steps 10 and 11. Oh God, step 10 is the bloody hardest step that there is out there. And when Ivana asked me to speak, or Johnny asked me to speak, I'm like, oh boy, if you could have seen me on Thursday at work, you would not be asking me to speak. Thursday was one of those days where I had an idea. Have you ever had one of those, an idea? And I woke up and I thought, I'm going to read the newspaper today instead of doing step 11. And it was almost that conscious. So I don't feel like doing step 11 this morning. I want to read. So I read the paper. And the rest was history. It was not a good day at work, I'll put it that way. Step 10, we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. This is one of those steps that I find the hardest to do perfectly, right? Because you can do step 9, you can finish step 9. It takes courage, it's work, it's effort. You have to go out and do it. Step 10, it never ends. And it says it in the big book, it goes on for a lifetime. And I have to boil it down to something very tangible. And so I sort of create some ideas that go alongside step 10. One of them, and I heard this from an older gentleman at my Monday night group on the Isle of Dogs in London named Billy S. And Billy said there are only three things he can control. He can control his actions, he can control his thinking, and he can control his attitude. There's nothing else he has any control over whatsoever, including the weather, including the DLR and whether or not it's on time, the Docklands Light Rail, including how other people behave, including who sends me emails at work, including everything, global warming, politics, Brexit, Boris Johnson, you name it. I have no control over any of it. I have control over those three things. And one of the things about the control over thinking, because what I've found is my date of sobriety is the 17th of August, 2010. Next month will be 9 years. And it's my second go. I enjoyed getting sober so much, I decided to do it twice. I was sober from 1999 to 2007, and then I decided to go out and do more research. And the research was concluded to my satisfaction that yes, I am indeed an alcoholic and an addict, of the hopeless variety, of the kind for whom other methods have failed. And so being, it's this, going back to what I was saying, you go back to the idea of clean mental hygiene. I am responsible for what I think. I am responsible for the thoughts I entertain. I am the one who gets to decide what I think about. And this idea came in very, very handy when I was new the second time around, because the first time I got sober in 99, I was 28 years old, and I would have this obsession every Friday night about vodka, about a martini, about beer. And that went on for like a year and a half. And somebody said, you know, Dr. Bob craved a drink. We craved a drug. The first year, the first 2 years, the first 3 years, Dr. Bob in his case was 2.5 years. The desire didn't leave him. And they said, just chill with it. It will pass. And it passed. But my second time around, I learned this trick, which was that I'm the one who gets to choose what I think about. And if I choose to fantasize about a nice cold beer, or I choose to stare as I go down the beer aisle, which is across from the Diet Coke and water aisle at Tesco's, I'm the one who gets to choose which side I look at. And if I look at the beer aisle and I stare at all these lovely lagers and ales, I will probably start having a mental reaction to what I am staring at. And out of that mental reaction will come something that all of us know is emotion. And my emotion will be, I want that. And I feel like I have to have that. So I don't think about it. Now, that is very easy to apply to booze. It's easy to apply to narcotics. It takes a lot more practice to apply that to the bastard on the tube who just stepped on my foot. Because in that moment, I want to get resentful because I'm right, and I love being right. I want to be right all the time, and I'm always right. And if I'm wrong, please have the grace to keep your mouth shut. So it's... I have to constantly remember that I'm the one who has dominion or control over my own thought life. I get to decide what I'm going to think about. And if I get to decide what I'm going to think about, it also means that I'm the one who gets to choose how to react to the behavior of other people. And so there are days where my actions are pretty clean. And you know, almost nine years sober, most of the time, my actions look pretty good, but my thought life and my attitude can suck catastrophically, to be quite frank, some days. And so it's the idea that I have to exercise discipline in my thought life, which is what makes step 10 a challenge, and which is what makes step 10 a lifetime's work. You know, a sponsee calls up and says, I'm obsessed about my ex, what do I do? And the answer is stop it. Just stop thinking about the ex. Read the newspaper, go for a run, think about tulips, think about beagles, give to a cat charity. You know, I don't know, like watch Love Island. Don't think about the ex. You're thinking about the ex because you're getting a kick off of it. I get a kick off of my own resentments. And that was a revelation. Wait, you mean I'm doing this on purpose because I'm enjoying it? And my sponsor says, yes, in some sick way you're enjoying this. I was 5 years sober. This was a few years ago. And I was very active. I still am. I mean, very active in recovery, two home groups because I'm greedy. I can't get by with one. A handful of sponsees, having completed every last amend, rock solid, center of the bed recovery. Now, I thought that gave me the right to not have to feel painful human emotions anymore. And therefore, if I'm feeling painful human emotions, then something is wrong with me. And at work, there was somebody who I chose to politely call at the time the bastard, and the enemy, the evil one, Voldemort. There was somebody at work who had a significant influence over my job who was in many ways behaving badly. And this person became the enemy, the center and the core of all my resentments. And the funny thing about when you have a resentment, while you have a million sponsees, tons of commitments, doing service at intergroup, two home groups, finished your amends, is, well, I'm clearly right. This guy's wrong. And my emotional response to it is completely natural and proportionate. And so that's when my sponsor pulled out one of the Al-Anon books and had me go through the steps in Al-Anon. And I say this because I was doing step 10 and it was just constant, recurrent, repetitive anger at this individual. And having been through inventory tons of times, what I saw in this step 10 was that this person had a nearly identical personality to me, a nearly identical ego, a nearly identical addiction to being right, a nearly identical addiction to control. And so part of step 10 and part of this process that I went through when I looked at this Al-Anon stuff, which is pretty much just about how do you deal with the rest of humanity, it became about how do I forgive this individual? How do I let go of the resentment? And I had to look at the causes of it behind it. And this is what step 10 showed me, is that this constant, repetitive, obvious observation of my own anger prompted me to say, all right, I'm doing this, I create the enemy in my job, because my prior job back in New York in the early 00s had another enemy. And there's always this recurring, repeating enemy at work, the person you can't stand. And what I found was that there was a certain need I had to create the enemy that had nothing to do with the enemy. It had to do with my own fear of being bored. And I like drama, and I need excitement, and I need the energy and the kick I get off of being furious. And once that observation was made, the anger and the animus and all the fire behind the resentment, whoop, gone. Like, wow, how does that happen? Now, granted, this took like 2 years of a lot of work. The point is that if I stick to the principles that are laid out in step 10, I will eventually be shown what the problem is. I don't have to come up with the answer right away. I will remain human no matter how long I am clean, no matter how long it's been since my last drink. I will remain human, and the answer, if I stay in it here, will always be shown to me. I will always get the answer. I sometimes talk about the elastic band. I never know how long my elastic band is. How far can I drift from recovery before I relapse? Some people are on a very short leash. Some people are on a decade-long leash. But if I am a real addict and a real alcoholic, eventually I will go back and drink and use again. And so the leash I have, I don't test how strong it is. I stay in it so that the leash never breaks. And the leash sort of can be defined as the home group, the sponsor, the sponsees, the service commitments, the service work at intergroup, the public information, the reaching out. This work we do here is what keeps me here and centered, because what happened to me the last time I was 8 years clean was I began to drift. And this will bring me a little bit into step 11. Let's just see where we are on time. Where are we on time? 15, perfect. The way I think about this is, you've kind of got two realms, R-E-A-L, realm. There's the realm of the material, and there's the realm of the spiritual. And this is how I kind of have to think about God, because I'm not a God person, I'm not a Jesus guy, none of it makes much sense to me. But they tell me you have a spiritual malady, you have a spiritual illness, therefore the solution to it can only be a spiritual solution. There's the material and there's the spiritual. The material is everything I can see and touch, and the material is where my wants and needs are. And I'm the type of addict, alcoholic, who has an infinitesimally profound demand for money, sex, power, prestige, comfort. I need lots of comfort. Things need to go my way all the time as I define them for me to be happy. And thrills and excitement. That's what I want from the world. And those wants are endless. And the more of those wants that get satisfied, the more money you get, the more success you get, the more sex you get, the better the relationship is, the better all that stuff is, the more I want of it, and the less I need a spiritual solution to my problem, which is fundamentally a separation from the rest of humanity. That is my fundamental problem. I am separated from you by my ego and by all this long list of demands. And once I was sober, in 2000, 2001, 2002, this became the priority. All of these things. And the further you get away from recovery, the smaller the solution that's on offer in recovery appears to me from this distance. And the less relevant it seems. I just need more of this. I just need to change the formula here to get it right so I can be permanently happy. And so I can get what I want. So, the reason why it's so important, steps 10 and 11, is because it keeps me grounded back in the spiritual realm. Because I can drift, my demands can get lopsided. I can lose, I guess, my spiritual compass is how I would say it. And if I lose that spiritual compass for long enough, I will forget that there is such a thing as a spiritual compass. So on Tuesday, I may walk into work and say, God, who, what program? I'm busy on the keyboard, typing away emails, getting rageful as I see the next email come in. But that night, I'm going to talk to my sponsor. If there was no sponsor to talk about, then I believe that this is the entire reality of my existence, and there's nothing spiritual. There is no program. There is no God. There is no rest of humanity. There's just my wants and my needs and what I have to have and what you haven't given me and what I require today, right now, to be happy and to be fulfilled. And if I stay in that space long enough, I will need a chemical solution to the problems of the material world. It's only in the spiritual world that I find the solution. And the only way I can access that spiritual world is through everything, steps 1 through 12, that's up there. And I stay connected to it through each one of those things on there. And so my step 11 looks pretty basic. There's 86 to 88. You read that in the morning. You do what it says on page 86 at night. We take a nightly review. When it's a real doozy, I'll share it. But I also had to branch out, because if I do the same thing over and over and over again, my ego is such that it will neutralize the page and turn it into blank. And I'll just read it and reread it, and I've read it for 5 years, and I've done it 5 years straight, never stopped, same thing. It's just my ego will find a way to use that. And so I flip it around. I use different spiritual books. All it takes for me to remember that there's a spiritual solution, to remember that I am an addict and an alcoholic and that I have a mind and an ego that will constantly always go back and use a substance no matter how long I am clean, 10 minutes in the morning reading a spiritual book will change my entire day. It reminds me that there is something bigger than this list of demands, this list of requirements. And even when I think I know that there's a solution over here, but I'm really busy thinking about all these things here and what I have to do that day, if I don't have that 10 minutes in the morning, that 15 minutes, a couple deep breaths, read a page of whatever spiritual tome it is I'm consuming at that moment. If I don't do it, it's like it has no force. And the other thing that I found with steps 10 and 11, in particular with step 11, is, and it sometimes, I think, helps to sort of draw a picture of what I looked like when I was 7 or 8 years sober the first time in. I'd wake up, I'd have multiple cups of coffee, nothing wrong with that, I still do it. And I'd read the newspaper and I'd go off to work. And running in the background, you know, if you've ever seen The Matrix, the film, you know, the computer screen there has this code that sort of drops down. My code is running. And the code runs along a line of, everything needs to be nice for me at all times. The tube cannot be late. I cannot be stuck. I can't be crowded. Why isn't the air conditioning running faster in this? I mean, it's boiling hot in here, and I'm in a suit, and I'm drenched, and I'm covered. Now I have to go into work, and that bastard sent me that email. I can't believe he didn't do it, and she didn't do her job. And this one's misbehaving, and I can't believe that person didn't shower. They smell horribly today. And the code is running. And it's my list of demands, it's my list of requirements of what I need from the world to be happy. So as that code runs, I need an alternate code. I need an antivirus program. And so step 11 is my Norton antivirus. And I won't be able to stay clean, to stay sober without that. And it's... When I was 7, 8 years sober, I'd go into work, I'd do my newspaper thing in the morning, and I'd be raging. I'd have the code running, and eventually my priorities I can summarize like this. My primary purpose in life was to have a successful career, have a partner, settle down, have enough money, get to the gym 5, 6 days a week, have a phenomenal body until I die at age 89. And at the end of that list, yeah, from time to time, I know I'm supposed to, my friends are all in AA, yeah, all right, I'll show up at the meeting every once in a while and sit in the back and think about myself. That's what my program looked like, and if I live in that space long enough, if I live in that zip code, in that postcode for long enough, I will use, and I know that. I know I will use. I will find the weak point in the dam. The weak point in the dam in 2007, it started with Valium. It's just a tablet. It's doctor prescribed. I'm anxious. I have to fly a lot for my job. I have to get on planes all the time. It's stressful. I'll find an excuse. And I came up with it like that. I took it as prescribed for 6 months. And then boom, off to the races, I turned into Chris Raymer's issue man. You know, the issue man, the stick figure. With all the issues. And then I was off and it almost killed me. So it nearly, and you know, they said to me when I came in, you had a foot and a half in the grave. You weren't gonna make it, you were one of the goners. And that's why a consistent application of step 11 is kind of the bedrock of my recovery. The last thing I wanna mention is, it comes back to a very fundamental question. Why are we all here? What are we doing in here? Many of us in this room have been clean or sober for many, many years. Is this about me having a good life for me? Is it about me getting what I want? And this sort of leads into step 12, which is next. I am not here, so I can be grateful about all the wonderful things that I have experienced in my journey in recovery. That's all a byproduct. That's a side effect. I am here to be involved and a member of the human race. And for me, as an addict and an alcoholic, what that means is I am here to serve you. This isn't about me and getting what I want and having a nice life and sharing grateful stories about my journey, my own spiritual, personal journey in recovery. This is about getting out there and helping people not die, right? That's why I am here. When I was in treatment, and I was 7-8 days sober, I didn't think I was gonna make it, right? I was convinced I was gonna leave treatment and die within a couple months, and therefore, I made a deal with God. Because when you've tried everything else, and nothing works, and everything has failed, workaholism, lots of time at the gym, better living through benzodiazepines, none of it works. Therapy, psychiatrists, spiritual books, on their own in isolation. Everything's failed and you're gonna die, but you don't wanna die. I made a deal with God, and the deal kinda went like this. If you keep me sober and clean for the rest of my life, I will do everything that is required of this program and everything that is asked of me, regardless of how I feel about it, regardless of my opinion of it, regardless of what my mood is at the time it is asked of me, regardless of what it means if I need to move, if I need to change careers, if I need to live in a different city, if I need to hang out with different people, I don't give a shit. I will do it. And I will do it for the rest of my life. And what happens when you make that surrender, that commitment, that step 3 deal, is you realize my entire purpose here is to save other people's lives. And what happens when that becomes your primary purpose is your entire value system changes, and it's a bit revolutionary. Your whole spirit changes. And it's pretty miraculous what happens in these rooms. It's you are given an insight into the fact that we are all connected, that we are all basically one. I know this sounds a little bit kooky, but Albert Einstein said, the greatest illusion of mankind is that there's more than one of us. There's not, we're all connected. I'm you, you're me. If I resent you, I'm resenting myself. That's why it hurts. If I'm angry at you, I'm angry at me. And that is a very precious gift. And so I think I will stop my blathering and rambling there. What I can say is what's on offer here is so much bigger and so much more vast than what I thought when I came in. So what a bloody gift. So thank you.
Thank you so much, John. Okay, I've got a couple of announcements to make. So I just want to take note that there is literature out on the table. Please go and visit the literature area. We've got the phone line.